Hello friends. Welcome to another Between Series special of Old Bones. These are episodes which I'm releasing whilst researching the next full season. Sometimes these episodes will be discussions, some will be teasers, others might be reviews, and still others, like today, will be interviews with archaeologists. However, before we introduce today's guest, there needs to be a few thank yous. We have hit 3,000 downloads, smashing my self-determined goal for season 1 three times over. This programme sits in a deliberately small niche. It exists for archaeology and archaeology's ability to help understand the human-centred planet. Archaeology is a subject which I think fascinates everyone in some small way, but there are only a limited number of outlets for people to indulge that fascination. The early success of this totally independent show has vindicated my belief that there is an audience for archaeological stories, so I want to use this small milestone as an opportunity to spread some gratitude. Every one of you who listens is absolutely vital to any small success that has fallen this show's way, so thank you very, very much. Some of you, though, have gone above and beyond the call of duty. Anyone who has told a friend or liked and shared a social media post, thank you, thank you, thank you. Please keep spreading the word and helping this podcast to keep on growing. To my patrons, Beth, David, John, Judy, and Vasco, thank you above all. Our small but growing community really does keep me going when I start to flag in the midst of editing hell. If you'd like to join them, please support me on Patreon. Any contribution which offsets some of the cost of the show is gratefully received. The show's artwork is done by Helena Constable Maxwell. She's a wonderful artist with a charming Instagram. I'm lucky to have her as a friend. A special shout out though needs to go to Ali, who has been a non-stop evangelist for the show. He hosts a podcast called Russophiles Unite, which I would strongly recommend. And finally, thank you to Beth, Laura and Josh for giving me the space to read, write and record, even during the lockdown. Links to Ali's show, my Patreon and Helena's artwork will be in the show notes. Let's get back to archaeology. Today's guest is Heather Beaton. I was introduced to her by my undergraduate dissertation supervisor, Ben Roberts. Ben is a specialist in the Bronze Age and used to work at the British Museum. He's written some very cool articles on things like Bronze Age swords, and that connection to ancient artifacts is where Heather comes in. Heather has an MA in Artifact Studies from Durham and currently works at the Portable Antiquity Scheme for the Liverpool area. I'll let Heather explain what the Portable Antiquity Scheme is like in more detail, but just so you know, the PAS is a scheme set up in 1997 so that when metal detectorists, amateur archaeologists, or just the general population discover an archaeological artifact, they can take it to their local Portable Antiquity Scheme office. There, the object is assessed. The finder can find out more about what they've discovered, and if it's treasure or significant, it will be valued and the discoverer will be paid for their find. That's what Heather does during the cold months when archaeologists hide indoors and leer over beautiful artifacts or vast datasets like Gollum in hiking boots. However, during the warmer months, she's also the finds officer for a Roman fort in Romania. More on that soon. Heather and I spoke in April, well into the midst of quarantine, which meant that my internet wasn't particularly happy with me using Zoom. That means you might hear the occasional audio glitch, and I've had to work around some of the worst areas. I'm very sorry about that. At any rate, let's get on to the show. I'm Andy Earnshaw, and welcome to Old Bones.
So I'm from Warrington, which is a town sort of in between Manchester and Liverpool. And I've always had an interest in archaeology, really. So sort of growing up, we spent a lot of time in museums, sort of up and down the country. And then I always had this sort of like more of a habit than, I don't know, a weird interest where at primary school, in the juniors, we had sort of this man-made hill. And I used to spend quite a bit of my time sort of during break, sort of like burrowing into this hill, looking for pieces of pottery. It used to drive my mum mad because I'd come home with sort of pockets full of really grubby pieces of just, I mean, it's just rubbish, really.
I'm glad I'm not the only one who would come back from visiting a castle or going to the beach and mum would throw it in the house. Like, can you just empty your pockets and out would fall like interesting stones and bits of pottery?
That was my childhood, digging mounds in my playground. I really enjoyed history at school. It was one of my favorite subjects. And then I was lucky that the college that I went to did A-level archaeology. Mm-hmm. So I got to do that, which was really fun.
So A-levels, for my non-UK listeners, are advanced levels. In England and Wales, when you are 16, you take your GCSEs. There are basic qualifications. After that, you choose 4 subjects and spend 2 years learning them in detail. At the end of that time, you get your A-levels. It's those A-levels which decide which university you might go to, and there are a whole load of other qualifications for those who wish to follow a more practical career path. Up until 2016, students were able to study archaeology at A-level, along with a whole host of other slightly niche subjects. The reason this podcast exists is that, like Heather, I was able to study archaeology at A-level. It was a life-changing opportunity, helping me realise there was a world outside of text and that the past is more than just what is written. The scrapping of archaeology at A-level was the moment I grasped the enormous effect politicians can have on our lives. Sir Tony Robinson, the presenter of Time Team and Baldrick himself of Blackadder fame, called this scrapping of archaeology A-level as a barbaric act, and I agree with him. It was unqualifiably stupid and short-sighted. Archaeology was an A-level which allowed those who found the methods of history uninspiring as a way to explore the past, and gave those who wanted to study non-traditional periods an opportunity to do so. You'd have thought a government with Churchillian overtones might be interested in promoting the study of the past, but unfortunately, it wasn't, quote-unquote, efficient, and so the subject got scrapped. Now, it might seem like a small thing, the removal of a few subjects from the curriculum list. However, it was borne out from a dogmatic focus on efficiency and the short-sighted ideological hollowing out of everything that education is supposed to stand for. I'll leave you to draw your own conclusions on how similar attitudes have affected other vital institutions like, I don't know, the NHS. And I know that's political and I don't care. I've wanted to express the emotion publicly for a long, long time, so I hope you'll forgive me. But let's get back to Heather before this episode becomes a diatribe.
And then from that point, I then went to uni. I went to Edinburgh and did ancient history and archaeology. So sort of interest kind of more lie in sort of the ancient world, sort of Greece and Rome. I like the Romans. I think that helps sort of being from somewhere near Chester. So when we were in, I think it was year 4, we went on a school trip to Chester. And finished my undergrad, did some excavation sort of in my summers whilst I was studying. And then I went to Durham to my master's there in
artifact studies. A quick bit of archaeological nomenclature here. In archaeology, there are different types of phenomena we can study. At the smallest and most detailed are artifacts. These are individual portable objects like stone hand axes or coins. If those artifacts are natural, like animal bones, then they are sometimes called ecofacts. Slightly larger than artifacts are features. Features can be small, like a single post hole, or huge, like ditches or fortresses. Burials are features, as are fences, or even some deliberately natural things like hedgerows. The pyramids, Stonehenge, the White House, and even your corner shop are all examples of features. Features and artifacts are often what grab the headlines. They're the foundations of archaeological study. But it can get a bit more complicated than that. When features and artifacts combine in the same small area, we get sites. These can be settlement sites like Cladhallan, or they can be religious sites like Starcar in Yorkshire. Sites are really important to study because they contextualise artifacts and features. By understanding how features relate to each other, we can begin to build up a picture of how a settlement functioned. By understanding which particular areas of a site certain artifacts were found, we can begin to label different parts of sites as accommodation, burial areas, disposal areas, or even religious places. By understanding the context of where artifacts are found, we can then also begin to say more about the artifact itself. And finally, there are landscapes. This is the largest thing an archaeologist can study. Landscapes are collections of sites, individual artifact finds, artificial and natural features. In the same way that studying sites contextualizes features and artifacts, studying landscapes contextualizes sites. Landscapes can be huge. For example, you can study the landscape of an entire American state or even the whole of England. Landscape, though, can also be much smaller, like studying the areas immediately surrounding the sites of Stonehenge or Boxgrove. This podcast relies on people like Heather. Artifact Studies is the laser focus on the artifacts themselves. Heather is the person on site who tells the excavators what it is they've discovered. She's the woman who will write the marvellously detailed reports on what artifacts were recovered from a site. Without people like Heather who specialise in one particular part of the archaeological record, shows like this one don't exist. I read her reports alongside landscape and site studies and use those to create an image of life in the past.
And then, yeah, after some time, I got this job working for the Portal Antiquity Scheme with National Museums of Liverpool. So, yeah, and I really enjoy it. It's really good when you get to do a job that, you know, that you really enjoy and into you all the time. And the really great thing about being sort of a finds liaison officer is that we see so many different objects. And we do, you know, we learn something new every day.
I think that's super interesting that your love of Romans comes from growing up near Chester. Mm. I will warn you that I badmouth Manchester and Liverpool quite often in the podcast because I'm from Yorkshire. So. but my like fascination is with the early medieval period, and that's because my earliest memories are going to the Orphic Centre in York, which was Chester. Yeah, so I find that very interesting. People's love of archaeology is often deeply, deeply in their childhood, and then they somehow ends up with them being very, very fascinated with just how many inches deep a piece of soil goes. I'm not 100% sure of the connection. Great. So obviously, I think we touched on it a little bit with the hint of the Romans. But tell me in your words, like, what your specialism is, especially during your MA. I know that was a lot of small fine stuff. Obviously, working in the Portal of Antiquity scheme is lots of small fine stuff. But tell me about your specialisms, what you're fascinated by, what really grabs your interest, and if you could do nothing else, what would it be? What would you be doing?
Oh God, that's such a loaded question. I mean, I don't know. I mean, So going to Durham, so my master's, do you know about Gary Bankhead, who does the dives into the River Wear just off Elvert Bridge?
Durham, guys, is a small cathedral city in the northeast of England. We'll have reason to discuss Durham in the future, I promise. It was founded during the late Anglo-Saxon period by some monks who had spent a couple of centuries dragging the corpse of St. Cuthbert around the northeast. They settled on Durham, which was founded on a rocky peninsula, surrounded on three sides by the rapid waters of the River Wear. The monastery, incidentally, that they founded kicked off over 1,000 years of education and study, which, in 1832, led to the foundation of Durham University, the first university to be founded in England since Cambridge 600 years earlier. In 2011, the university had the misfortune of accepting me to study for my undergrad, which is how I met the people who would later on introduce me to Heather, who also studied her postgraduate degree at Durham. Now, as I mentioned, Durham is on three sides, surrounded by a river. A crazy, crazy dude called Gary Bankhead decided to begin diving into the ice-cold waters of the River Wear, searching for artifacts. He is an underwater archaeologist, which remains to me the coolest job title it is possible to have. Gary is now a research associate at Durham, and his dives have revealed hundreds of beautiful finds. They range from the prosaic, everyday things like the brooches we find all across the country to the truly, truly impressive, like a pilgrim's badge from the 1300s, potentially thrown into the river after the pilgrim reached the shrine of St. Cuthbert and wished to make an offering to the saint.
Yeah, he's been bringing up sort of like thousands of objects in the past few years. So got to sort of do a report on one of those, which was a bodkin, which I was dreaming about bodkins and I hated it. It was fun, but it was really stressful. And then the second object was from Durham's Oriental Museum, which is like a Egyptian faience bead. And it was really lovely. A bit crude, but it was a nice object. And I've always loved Egyptian stuff. I think, I don't know what child doesn't love Egyptian things, honestly. And that's always really stuck with me. So, but then, yeah, sort of like my final paper was on sort of fakes and forgeries. So again, I looked at an object from Durham's Oriental Museum, which was a silver oyster shell pendant, which had a cartouche on it.
You'd recognise a cartouche if you saw one, guys. You find them all over Egyptian objects. A cartouche is a rectangle with rounded corners carved into rock or metal or drawn on papyrus. Within the cartouche are hieroglyphics, and the cartouche tells you that those words are all related. But not just related. When there's a cartouche in a script, it means the words inside relate to a royal name. On Wikipedia, the main image is the cartouche of Thutmose III, but I read it as crane, spade, grain, beetle, because I'm a hieroglyphically illiterate fool.
And it was sort of, it was in the notes that it had been, that it was a fake. And so I sort of explored, you know, to what extent is it a fake? And so the ending result was that the object itself is ancient Egyptian, is genuine, but that the cartouche was added sort of much later, sort of like 18th, 19th century kind of thing. But yeah, that's all that. But I think, like, I don't know, to be honest, the thing that kind of really sort of piques my interest is anything that's just a little bit different. I mean, like I said, I like Roman things, and I don't know. I like all things. The older the better, honestly.
Okay, well,
to be honest.
Sorry, go on.
No, you go.
I was going to say, I 100% get that. As much as I love the early medieval period, there's a reason why I started out this show in British prehistory. Because all of it's great. It's the hardest thing was choosing where to start. What's your opinion on things like artifact biographies? Is that sort of more theoretical approach interesting to you, or are you much more interested in just understanding the object and its sort of role in society, or is it just more the object itself that fascinates you?
So, you know, I was telling you about artifact studies. Well, an artifact biography is when you essentially write a story for the object you are studying. These can be pretty dull, simply reciting where the object was made, how it was potentially used, and how it was deposited. However, many people go further and explore who it was given to, how it was handled and traded, and why it was deposited in a particular way. When you get very good, artifact biographies reveal to us not just the story of the artifact, but the story of those who came into contact with the object, how they affected the artifact, and potentially how the artifact affected them.
I mean, I think that kind of comes into the whole idea of object biographies anyway. I mean, when you get these small finds, it's really interesting to see, you know, where they came from, how they got to where they were found, and you can sort of look if the object has, you know, if it's been changed in any way, which is quite often the case in some objects that are in museums, especially ones that were sort of, you know, collected during the grand tours that all aristocratic males went on. And you sort of, you know, it becomes part of the object's history, and it becomes part of their context and part of their importance. So I like looking into all of that as well. But I mean, you know, even then it can be fascinating when, you know, you're on a site and you're excavating, and then, you know, this object comes up and you're like, that's just amazing. How did they get there? Why is it in the condition that it's in? You know, why was it left here? And I think all part of that is really sort of interesting to the whole idea of, you know, what is an artifact and the history that it had, and, you know, the context, like historical context and social importance that it might have had. I kind of like all of that stuff, and I think it's all really interesting.
It is, and that's the thing is, I always knew this, but one thing that sort of, because I, bit of context would be, I did my undergrad at Durham, graduated in 2014, and I wasn't mature enough yet to do a master's. I was not growing up yet. I knew that if I did a master's at that stage, I would waste the opportunity for career. I was like, I'm going to go learn. And I also felt that lots of archaeologists didn't know much about the world of business, something I will definitely cut from when the final recording. So I went and did sales and marketing. So I went and had an experience in the world of alcohol, and then the world of tech startups for a few years, which is where I am currently. And as I'm sort of getting to the point where I'm returning to my subject and the thing that I'm really passionate about, I want to do in my life, I've been really reminded, just first of all, how collaborative archaeology is as a subject. And it's one of my favourite things about it is you and me could have completely differing interests in archaeology. Yeah, there's a strong chance that we'll end up working together, or we'll end up, you know, or we can learn something from each other in a really practical way. Which brings me to my question. There's so much in archaeology you can do. Even, you know, even if you're like me, you're not a scientist, you've still got theoretical archaeology, artifact study, landscape archaeology, funerary archaeology, on top of all the some more scientific studies. So what is it about artifacts versus things like landscapes or funerary archaeology or more of the scientific side of things or theoretical archaeology? What is it specifically about artifacts versus all the other things that make up archaeology that really grabs your attention, you know, prompted you to do an artifact study, MA?
Basically, you can touch it. You can touch it, you can feel it, and it's, you know, the fascination that the object that you're touching is, you know, 3,000-5,000 years old and was once used by a real person. You know, you're looking at a brooch and it's like, well, somebody wore this. You know, you get a Roman brooch, you think somebody wore this, you know, 1,500-2,000 years ago. But yeah, I think that's just what sort of always made it far more interesting for myself, is just the connection that you can feel immediately with the past as soon as you're touching this object. And yeah, I just think that, you know, you get a much stronger feel with the importance of an object than you would if it's just sort of the general wider context.
If there's somebody listening and they were like, oh, I love that thought process, I love that approach, and that is what grabs me about the past, I want to learn more about that. Well, what would you say is a really good introduction to learning more about the artifacts of archaeology or experiencing the artifacts in archaeology? Is there a book they can read or something that you love particularly?
I mean, the first place I think anyone should always go to is a museum, a whole array of objects, not just archaeological, but all sorts. So I think that's a really good way to sort of get in there straight away. Books that just have, you know, general objects from, you know, different time periods, you know, whether it's the early medieval period, Egyptian, Greek. I think just sort of looking at the different types of objects, just some from pictures, I mean, that would always, you know, get me quite excited. One of the things I really enjoyed sort of doing my master's when it came to the artifact study side of it was just being able to look at all these books. I mean, one that I remember in particular was on Egyptian faience, and it was just, you know, a book full of, you know, bright blue, and it was a stunning book, I think, something like that. I mean, I like pretty things. I think the prettier the book, I think the more engaging it can be.
faience. There are two types: normal faience, which is tin glazed pottery, and Egyptian faience, which is altogether more interesting to us right now. Egyptian faience is a type of ceramic which has a glass-like surface. Basically, it's pottery, but made out of quartz rather than clay. This means it can be poured, moulded, and covered in different glazes, giving the object the most incredible blue and green colours. This is going to be such a good episode to follow on Instagram. There will be images of faience on there, as well as images of every other artifact type we've discussed, for which I can find non-copyrighted images.
One thing that I was really glad you said when we were emailing about this was I'm really into the Portable Antiquity Scheme at the moment.
And oh, good.
I was like, that's great. The way I'm going to build quite a few of these is an interview with an archaeologist. It's actually, guys, you hear me talking about this. You hear me building these big narratives every month about what it can tell us. But actually, there's a whole load of research and study and detailed study that goes into actually building up into those big narratives. And I think a lot of people, this is my version of behind the scenes, because rather than me saying, here's all the books that I read, it's like, actually, no, let's talk to the people who are writing and developing the stuff that I read. So talk to me, though, a little bit about the Portable Antiquity Scheme. Assume that I or the listeners know nothing about what it is, because I can tell you what, I've mentioned it to a few people and it's been glazed over. So this is your opportunity to promote the PAS and tell people what the Portable Antiquity Scheme is.
basically what we facilitate is when members of the public find objects that appear to be archaeological, they can bring them to us, our team finds liaison officers, and we're stationed all across England and Wales. I think there's just over 40 of us, I think, in total. I mean, it changes as people come and interpost and leave post. And yeah, basically we sort of look at the objects and we take them in and we put them onto this big online database, which is can be found at finds.org.uk. And it's all free to access and anyone can research, anyone can look at the database, even just, you know, for interest. You can sort of search, you know, I'm from Warrington, so I could have a look and say, oh, what finds were found from Warrington? And I might be able to learn a little bit more about, you know, the town that I'm from and everything. So it's a really good way to sort of learn just generally a little bit more about, you know, your local heritage, engage with the wider public, engage with the public about what archaeology is, why archaeology is, you know, interesting and why it's important, why heritage is important. And basically, you know, we like to try and tell stories through these objects. We research these objects. And the PAS also helps to facilitate the Treasure Act. So when someone finds an object that looks like it should be treasure, they bring it into their local finds liaison officer, and then we do all the legal side of things. So we declare it to the coroner, and then we do sort of like the artifact reports, which then goes to our central unit, which is at the British Museum. And then, yeah, that's a really long and lengthy process.
With regards to the Treasure Act, the Gospel of Wikipedia speaks thus. The Treasure Act of 1996 is a UK Act of Parliament defining which objects are classified as treasure, legally obliging the finder to report their fine. The Act is designed to deal with finds of treasure in England, Wales and Northern Ireland. It legally obliges finders of objects which constitute treasure as defined in the Act to report their fine to the local coroner within 14 days. That's right, by the way. The coroner, the guy who usually is in charge of inspecting bodies which died in suspicious ways, is also the main guy for archaeological artifact discoveries in Britain. Long story, not for now. An inquest led by the coroner then determines whether the find constitutes treasure or not. If it is declared to be treasure, then the finder must offer the item for sale to a museum at a price set by an independent board of antiquities experts known as the Treasure Valuation Committee. Only if a museum expresses no interest in the item or is unable to purchase it can the finder retain it. For the purposes of the Act, treasure is defined as being 1. All coins from the same find, if it consists of 2 or more coins and as long as they are at least 300 years old when found. If they contain less than 10% gold or silver, there must be at least 10 in the find for it to qualify as treasure. 2. 2 or more prehistoric base metal objects in association with one another. 3. Any individual coin find that is at least 300 years old and contains at least 10% gold or silver. 4. Associated finds. Any object of any material found in the same place as, or which has previously been together with, another object which is deemed treasure. 5. Objects substantially made from gold or silver but are less than 300 years old that have been deliberately hidden with the intention of recovery and whose owners or heirs are unknown. The Treasure Act allows for a reward up to the market value of the treasure to be shared among the finder and the tenants and or owner of the land on which the treasure was found. End quote.
But yes, yeah, it's a really big scheme, and it's, you know, it's a really wonderful scheme to work for. You know, we often sort of say that, you know, we're a big family, and it really does feel like that when we have, you know, 40 plus finds liaison and officers, you know, plus our line managers, plus we used to work for the scheme. I think once you're in the scheme, you never really leave it. And of course, all our, you know, wonderful finds advisors as well, who are sort of, you know, experts at, you know, around the country. So. Yeah, that's a bit about the scheme, I guess.
I had a few very nerdy questions, but I think you managed to tick all of them off. How does it interact with other archaeological bodies in the UK? Done. How does it engage with the public? Done. What's it like to work there? It's like a family. Done. That's great. So I guess the next thing that I want to just understand, because, you know, another thing you mentioned, the thing on your profile, is the work you do in Romania. So why don't you tell me a little bit about Romania?
Okay, Romania is really fun. So I joined the team of the archaeology at Halmyris project a couple years ago, just finishing my master's degree. And basically, we are an international team who excavate a Roman fort on the Lower Danube in Romania. So we're quite close to the coast. And we're based in the fort is called Amiris, which is sort of based just outside this small town called Murigyol. And yeah, excavations have been going on at the site since the 1980s. So it's progressed an awful lot since then, sort of in terms of archaeological technique and processes. And yeah, so my sort of role with the team has sort of developed into being the finds processor. So it's actually very similar to what I sort of do with PAS in that, you know, I identify the objects, I measure the objects, I weigh the objects, and I'm sort of working on sort of databasing the objects and everything. So unfortunately, we haven't got a season this year, sort of, you know, as a big pandemic going on, in case you didn't know. So we had to sort of cancel the season. So we're trying to organize a good off season for the team at the moment. But yeah, you know, we're going from strength to strength every year. I mean, last year we had over 40 volunteers. And our volunteers come from all over the place. A lot of them come from the States, but we do get quite a few from the UK as well. We have a lot of our students come from Durham University, basically, but we're not actually affiliated with the University of Durham. We just get a lot of students there. So a few of our team members have been doing their PhDs with Durham. I went through Durham. Our director, he did his PhD at Durham many moons ago. So yeah, but we're a really interesting team. And it's just really fascinating to sort of see sort of how the fort was. So the fort is sort of its late Roman period. So we're sort of looking into like early, late antiquity. And sort of, you know, those, you can see the different phases of the fort, sort of phases of sort of reconstruction and everything. And it's quite close to, so although we're not too far from, I think we're a couple of kilometers away from the Danube now, but the Danube used to sort of like basically be on the edge of the fort. So the fort used to have a harbor. We think we know where the civilian settlement is. We have yet to find the necropolis. But yeah, it's a really interesting site, and it has really interesting archaeology for early Christianity as well. So it has a crypt in the center of the fort, which is really quite unique in terms of the saints that were found there quite a few years ago now, whose name escaped me.
Again, I will
focus more on the finds.
Tell me the name of the fort, I'll do the punch-ins, I'll do all the research, and I'll just do a whole, like, this is what she means.
The fort where she is finds offer is called Halmeris. It's a beautiful place. It's close to the Black Sea coast where the Danube and ocean meet. The site is notable historically as the burial of two saints, Epictet and Astion. Their crypt was discovered in 2001 and declared a holy site by the Romanian Church, which would be great, except that it means that the same church is preventing archaeological excavation and preservation of the feature, which seems short-sighted and ironically iconoclastic. In less contentious news, Halmeris was one of the vital Danube forts, which protected the Roman Empire in a similar way to the forts along Hadrian's Wall, except that, instead of having a wall, these forts had a massive river to protect the forts. Halmeris probably acted as the point where the Roman fleet in the region was resupplied and was vitally important to Roman defences, being the place where the land defences met the ocean defences, both of which were regularly put under periodical strain by the people living outside the Roman Empire. Heather's role is as finds officer on this excavation, making sure that every find that comes out of the trenches is cleaned and catalogued effectively, which is vital, vital work. So many old-school excavations were let down because they didn't have someone like Heather ensuring every find entered the record.
Let me ask quite a nerdy question.
Yeah.
Obviously, you know, a 30-odd-year, 40-odd-year-old excavation, that's a big project. What's the research goals? What is it just that they're trying to dig a full fort in Romania, or are there any specific questions that they're trying to answer by doing this long, long dig at this site?
Well, I think the main sort of research goals, we were talking about these the other evening, actually, we had a team meeting, essentially to sort of understand the role of the fort during late antiquity, and sort of the reoccupation of the fort from civilians. So once the fort was, basically once the Romans moved out and they said, we're done with this, we don't want to do this anymore, the sort of local civilians moved, because obviously when you have a Roman fort quite often, or you know, a military settlement, you obviously get a local civilian settlement, which is used called Vicus, or Vicky for plural, which come with it. And they sort of travel around with the military, which is often why you have sort of, you know, military wives and families. So basically what we're trying to establish, one of our research goals is trying to establish what happened after the Romans left and, you know, the reoccupation of the site.
Yeah. And what kind of Roman forts, there's a pretty typical palimpsest coming out of it, but what sort of things have you guys been finding specifically from the late antiquity period? That's really interesting that it is from the late antiquity, you know, there is, it's a late antiquity site, because obviously that's what I'm going to be talking a lot about in a few months' time when I, but in Britain, we were talking about Burd Oswald and all those sites, which were kind of Roman forts that then became, centers of power and civilian centers of power. I don't know if you ever got to experience the majesty that was Binchester.
No, I didn't. As a master's student, we didn't get to do, I think that was more targeted for the undergrads. But yeah, that always looked like such a fun excavation. And so anyone who I know have gone through Durham was like, yeah, Binchester.
Yeah, I love Binchester. It's where I learned to dig.
I won't lie, I wasn't very good. By the end of the dig, they put me in a 1,500-year-old rubbish dump alone on the far edge of the trench, where I wouldn't distract the other students.
So what sort of finds, especially from that late antiquity, late Roman, early post-Roman sort of period, have you guys been finding?
I mean, we'd be finding all sorts. Because occupation of the site started sort of in the late 1st century BC, we do get an awful lot. And because there was quite a bit of interference with the site sort of during the communist period, not actual excavations, but just kind of being like, we know the site is here and we know it's interesting. So they kind of just sort of mess with it, really. So we do get quite a bit of contamination within the soil. So it's not always a straight, clear stratigraphy, which can be a bit frustrating. So we could be digging, you know, a good few centimeters deep, and then we come up with something really modern, like a piece of plastic. Like, ugh, okay. So it is a bit... it's a bit messed up sometimes. But I know sort of like the key finds from last year, we found a complete crossbow brooch, pin and everything, which is stunning. It was really lovely. But, and that was in the first week of excavation as well. So I was like, yes.
It was all downhill from there. That's a
It was. No, it was a good season. And we found some... we found two figurines, sort of about, yeah, around like this big. I mean, they were copper alloy and they're quite corroded, but sort of based on the form, and we did some sort of research and spoke to some other people in that kind of research area. They seem to be statuettes, one of Isis and one of Osiris, which is really cool. Yeah, so that was really exciting find. And yeah, we find an awful lot of pottery, obviously.
Isis, Osiris, and their child Horus are a holy trinity from ancient Egypt. Let me tell you their myth, which I've taken verbatim from www.unrv.com, a brilliant site for all your Roman needs. Myth tells how Osiris, the first god-king of Egypt, introduced laws and agriculture to humankind. He was then deceived and murdered by his scheming brother Seth, god of chaos. Seth hacked Osiris's body into pieces and scattered them across Egypt, intending to rule Egypt himself. But Isis collected the pieces and magically revived her brother husband Osiris, who became king of the underworld. She also magically conceived a son, Horus. Isis and her supporters warred against Seth for the throne of Egypt. A council of gods eventually decided that Horus, as son of Osiris, was the rightful ruler, and Seth was demoted to fighting nocturnal demons. A new paradigm emerged in which Osiris ruled the underworld, Horus ruled Egypt, and the pharaohs were considered the incarnation of Horus, and Ra, the sun god, ruled the heavens. But Isis, as mistress of magic, resurrected Osiris and thus was superior to him. She conceived her son Horus magically and was superior to him. With her magic, she even had power over Ra, the sun god. In short, she was the real power behind the universe, which led her cult adherents to claim her as mistress of heaven. More importantly, she had the power over life and death, and could resurrect her followers in the same manner that saved her husband from oblivion. As the myth of Isis and Osiris grew, Isis began displacing other deities in the loyalties of the population. End quote. As Rome became a global empire, non-Roman deities flooded into the Roman heartlands. Isis and Osiris became especially popular. As a couple, they represented family and rebirth. Isis especially became very popular with women. After a bit of worrying over how non-Roman the cult of Isis and Osiris was, Their cult was eventually accepted by officials, and the cult of Isis became a critical part of Roman religious life.
But we find some inscribed pottery, sometimes inscribed in Greek. So last year we also found like a small vessel that was basically complete. It had broken post deposition, so sort of like the toe had just come off it. But the sort of the one the co-director, his he's from Romania, his wife was down, and she's the she restores objects, and not quite, I don't know if she's a conservator, but she restores ceramics and everything, so she sort of put it back together, and it was a stunning little thing. I have a soft spot for pottery.
I think pottery's an odd one, because I do too. I think it's that I don't know if it's a bit like Stockholm syndrome. You see so much of it in archaeology that if you don't love it, you're kind of a bit stuck into it. Doing your job. It's fascinating. I remember my first year, Derek Kennett teaching me about pottery, and I was like, this is going to be so dull. Then he gave me a first, and now I love it.
First will do that to you.
Did not get a first in the rest of the degree, but that was a high point. I was like, okay, apparently I like pottery now. Great. Just on that though, in Romania, the civilians that were moving in after the Romans left, would you consider those Byzantine, or were they outside the Eastern Empire or the Byzantine Empire?
Oh, I'm not sure, honestly. Late antiquity isn't really sort of my thing. And I mean, I think with a lot of sort of just generally sort of like ancient populations, I think thinking too much about an identity, sort of how we identify isn't necessarily how they identify themselves. So they might have still identified themselves as Romans. They might identify themselves as you know, something along the lines of Byzantines. They might identify themselves as Dacians.
So just something that I always find interesting, especially because I've been watching a lot of Time Team recently, and how they pick up a pot, look at it, clean it up a little bit, and they obviously say with certainty for the cameras, this is how old this is.
Yeah.
How, beyond just what your job's like, obviously lots of measuring and weighing, but beyond just recording the finds, how much interpretation are you doing on the sites? How much feedback are you giving to the excavators? How much can you learn right there on the trench side? I mean, obviously I know there's a huge amount of work that goes into verify that, but how much work are you guys doing and how much of a narrative are you guys building as you dig?
I mean, we try to build as much of a narrative as we can, focus and hone in on all the material that we've been digging up the past couple of years. We're hoping to get a few publications out, sort of what's going on, and sort of look at, you know, especially the pottery, which is all beautiful. really like looking at it and sort of understanding what's going on. I mean, obviously the best thing is coins. I mean, we love it when we get a coin because the coin tells us everything we want to know. We found lots of coins last year, actually, more than usual. Sometimes in really good condition, and sometimes they're just really awful.
How good are you at doing the whole thing where you brush it off, look at it, go, oh yeah, that's Trajan?
I'm getting pretty good at it. I'm doing a lot better at it these days.
That's one of my life goals.
I'm quite good at my Roman bust.
Good. That's one of my life goals, is to be able to look up a Roman coin and go, oh yeah, that's the theme.
Yeah. I mean, working with PAS, I mean, that's sort of, I came into post in September, and I've recorded close to 100 Roman coins, if not more, actually. I've recorded a lot anyway. So I'm getting quite good at IDing them. And just sort of based on like the stuff I did for my undergrad, I'm quite good at sort of seeing looking at a Roman emperor and knowing who's who, basically. You know, you can look at someone and be like, oh, that's Hadrian, and you definitely know who Nero is with his really chubby neck. But yeah, it is like the ultimate life goal to just go, oh yes, that's a
that's all markets there. Which brings it back lovely on to the Port by Antiquity scheme and Warrington and the wrong side of the Pennines. What have you learned, obviously, you know, in 8 months or so into your role, what have you learned or what really sticks out in your mind as having learned about the area you're from, and what has the Portal Antiquity Scheme taught you, not just in terms of archaeological method, getting better identifying coins, but in terms of what have you learned about the story of where you grew up?
So something that, you know, I never used to be sort of particularly bothered about sort of medieval or, sorry, early medieval stuff. but sort of since I've been, you know, sort of doing the role, you know, if something comes in that's medieval, I get really excited because it's not post-medieval. and early medieval is really quite exciting, especially if it's from, if it's local. I mean, we don't have an awful lot of medieval finds coming up, and that's actually quite interesting. So that's one of the things that I didn't know at first. I didn't know how rare early medieval finds were and how rare they were sort of northwest and especially sort of around Cheshire. So that's really interesting to know. I think that's one of the things I really enjoy about the job too, is that being posted in sort of my home area. I think one of the fortunate flows to, you know, from Cheshire, and I get to look at finds and play with finds from Cheshire, as well as Merseyside and Manchester, which is, yeah, it's really good.
That's great. Which, and again, leads me nicely onto my, the closing questions, which is, there's a few. There's not too many. The kind of more quick fire, they're meant to be just off the cuff, not too thought about. But what's the best thing about your job?
Playing with objects all day. I don't play with them. Researching them. juggling them around. It's definitely being able to work with objects all day, and I think that really sort of. That kind of like reflects what I was saying earlier about how, you know, when you get to touch an object, you really get to feel its history. I also really enjoy meeting people, which is something that I never thought that I would enjoy. I was quite a shy teenager, I think, and sort of as I went through university and, you know, became more of an adult, you know, I got used to sort of talking to more people. So, you know, I meet some interesting characters.
And the flip side, unfortunately, is what's the worst thing about your job or being an archaeologist?
I think, to be honest, one of the worst thing is I think when you just start getting a bit snowed under, when you get an awful lot of finds in. But honestly, I think one of like the worst bits about the job can be the treasure process. it can be quite stressful at times, and it's just sort of, you think, oh, I've got a good week coming up, this is really good, and you know I've got, you know, I'll do some find recording, I'll do some Photoshop photography, maybe sort of write a blog post.
Too many finds.
It was the last day. It was just before Christmas, and it was the last day I was in the office before sort of breaking up for Christmas, essentially. And it was in the afternoon, and I got news. A finder came in. He was dropping off a few things, which was fine. And I didn't realise he was dropping off treasure. No, he dropped off it. It was a small object. Nothing too extraordinary at all. A lovely object still, but it was just sort of. You know, it's like, I go home in 2 hours. Why are you giving me treasure? So, you know, it can kind of add to the stress sometimes. But it is also fun, and you do get some really interesting stuff coming in. So, yeah, great. there's a good side to everything.
Okay, well, that's I love that optimism and that positivity. What do you wish you'd been told before you went into the weird world of archaeology?
I wish I'd been told that it's really hard. it can be really hard sometimes. I always knew that. Sorry?
In what way is it hard?
It can be hard in terms of getting funding, for one. I mean, I know some of my friends from university, I mean, they just sort of strolled into it, and, you know, they were really fortunate. But then there was a few of us who really sort of struggled for a while to get a job. And no matter how many interviews I had and how much experience I tried to get, they always said, oh, well, there was someone with a bit more experience than you. I'm like, oh, again. But to be honest, that whole time I spent looking for a job was worth it, because I ended up with, you know, a job that I really wanted and that I really enjoyed and was in the perfect place for me.
Great. Thank you so much for your time. It's been...
Oh, thanks for having me.
I'm really, really enjoying just speaking to lots of different people doing lots of different things in archaeology. And just what I love about them all is they're also friendly and also... passionate about what they're doing. So yeah, huge, huge thank you for taking the time and speaking so enthusiastically about your subject.
Oh, well, thank you. I've really enjoyed it. Something new for me. But yeah, it's been really good. So
good.
Thank you.
Brilliant. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Next season, artifacts are going to be deeply important to our story. Changes in brooch styles, shifts in coinage, and the dispersal of grave goods are vital to understanding how identities change in the early medieval period. I hope this episode has helped you understand what artifacts are, how we use them, and just how special, even magical, they can sometimes be. Thank you, of course, to Heather. She was a wonderful guest, friendly and interesting to listen to. If you like this format, let me know at oldbonespodcast@gmail.com. There are more interviews with more wonderful guests on the way. However, before then, we've got a really fun episode in the works. We're going back to the early Bronze Age to have a walk around the landscape of Avebury, England's greatest henge. In the meantime, you know where to reach me. On Instagram, where images associated with this episode can be found, and on Facebook, where I share articles and podcasts about archaeology and history. Search Old Bones for both. The website is oldbones.co.uk, and I am also on Patreon for those generous folk who want to help offset the costs of this show. We're growing in number, but this podcast is still far from profitable. I'd love your support. Search patreon.com/bonesandstuff or click the link in the description. I'll see you soon. I'm Andy Earnshaw, and this is Old Bones.